Hey, let me just tell you quickly that how the idea for this conference grew out of, we were hosting luncheons for journalists in Washington, and we had four or five a year with prominent scholars, and the Pew Foundation was funding it, and for about 3 or 4 years, and I got back in contact with my contact at the Pew Foundation, a program officer, a man named Luis Lugo, who is presenting today, and I said, Luis, we'd like to renew. And he said, think bigger. I said, six lunches? Eight? He said, no. And this is a quote I heard once from him, and I've not heard from anyone else again. By the way, if you want to adopt this quote yourself, I'm quite open to it. Luis said to me, think as if money were not an object. What would you do? I said, well, I have to call you back. And then I said, why not, let's don't do it here. Let's go to South Beach. At that time, Key West, now South Beach. And so the idea was to help us focus on these issues in a setting that was away from the hubbub of New York and Washington and think together on these very important issues. So Luis Lugo very generously and the Pew Foundation funded this conference for 10 years. And we were having lunch a couple of months ago when he was telling me about the data he's about to share with us. And I said, Luis, it's about time that you spoke here. And he's agreed to do so. So we're delighted. Luis's bio is in your packets. He has a PhD in political science from University of Chicago. He's director of the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life. Before that, he was director of programming at the Pew Foundation in Philadelphia. The Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life is in Washington, D.C. And Luis has been the director of an incredible amount of important survey data and research data on how everybody across the spectrum votes that's religious. And he's put that data together for us now, and we've got an updated form. And so, Luis, thank you, sir, for you've now gone from being an observer to being a presenter.
I know. That's great. It's great to be back. Thank
Pull
you,
the Mike. Mic up close.
I do have to note, though, that punctuality seems to be slipping since we severed our partnership. I keep telling my fellow Hispanics that one of the greatest contributions we can make to American society is to make sure that every meeting starts and ends on time. Yes, I usually get big laughs from them, but I felt that burden ever since we replaced Germans as the single largest ethnic group in this country. So, but we'll see if I get any takers. Where's Goldberg, by the way? I thought he was well. Why aren't you over here? This presentation, much more than the previous one, needs your levity and your good humor. You're an expert on everything, so you should just hire him to be the official responder to everything, right? So, well, it is great to be back. I really miss the stimulating discussions at these conferences and hobnobbing with the very interesting folks, journalists, and not incidentally, of course, being here in South Florida, enjoying the nice weather. Anytime you ask a Cuban to come anywhere close to Miami, we jump at the chance. So it's our capital in exile, as many of you know. Now, the Pew Forum changed its business model, if you want to call it that, some years ago. As the name suggests, we were essentially a convening organization. And we made the decision to transform ourselves into a research organization as part of the Pew Research Center. And so we had to sort of trim some things so that we can do some things bigger and better on the research side. And this was the one program, I have to be very honest with you, that really pained me to go away from, because I know how valuable it is. I would, after all of these sessions, I would get very nice notes from journalists who participated. And I'm just delighted, Mike, that through your entrepreneurial spirit, you've been able to keep it going. Thank you to other funders who see the value of this. I hope you keep it going for many, many more years. It's really quite a treasure in journalist education. So I think this is terrific. I'm glad to be part of it. Thank you also for sandwiching me between two less, let's say, heavy-duty, data-intensive talks. I'm not sure. You probably have a revolution on your hands if you had started with this one or ended with it. I'm not even sure a deep data dive like we're attempting here this afternoon is compatible with Miami Beach. It's just a certain incompatibility there. But then I reminded myself that I've always been perplexed at how a great number of Orthodox Jews managed to coexist with this very hedonistic place. So I figured, okay, well, if they can pull that off, maybe this will work after all. But, you know, data are us. We tell stories at the Pew Research Center with data. I mean, that's what we do. So I affectionately call us Data R Us. And not only do we do that, but I tend to do it with PowerPoint presentations. So it's, two downers right there, data heavy and PowerPoint. I am obsessed now with PowerPoint. I can't talk without PowerPoint. It underscores the wisdom of Lord Acton. Power corrupts and PowerPoint corrupts absolutely. It definitely applies to me. Now, I'm going to be going through a lot of figures here, but not nearly as many figures as you'll be seeing up there. I'm going to be very selective with the data that I pull out to tell the basic story that I want to tell. And I would like for you to be equally selective with what you jot down for discussion purposes. All the information we produce at the Pew Research Center is for the public interest. We don't charge people. So any of you who want me to send you an electronic copy of this PowerPoint, I'd be delighted to do it and to further discuss it with you. But let's both be selective. If not, we will literally never get through. So the basic task that Mike asked me to talk about, the topic to broach, was the decline of institutional religion. And I could have approached this in a variety of ways, that show the loosening of institutional ties between the American public and their religious institutions. I could have started, for instance, a topic which we have researched quite at depth, the whole phenomenon of religious switching. And the increasing lack of brand identity, if you want to call it that, or brand loyalty. More than half of Americans have changed their religious affiliation at least once in their lifetime. And of those who have, the majority have changed more than once. So I recently gave a talk to seminary presidents. I talk a lot to religious leaders. They just always find that, quite astounding. How do we run our institutions when you've got that amount of churn? So we could have started there. We could have also looked at quite a bit of research we've done on what former participant, I don't know when the last time he was here, David Brooks, called flexidoxy, clearly indicated. Even the most conservative groups, it would surprise you, including evangelicals, who say that, many religions lead to eternal life. And there are many ways to interpret one's religion. There is a kind of flexidoxy which, serves to loosen people's connection to their religious institutions. I could also talk about the majority who place, more weight on their religion adjusting to new circumstances, including adopting modern beliefs and practices, as opposed to preserving traditional beliefs and practices. So the default position for Americans is change here, and it manifests itself in a variety of ways. But I think the most powerful way in which I can illustrate this is talking about the growing number of Americans who, when we ask them about their religious affiliation, choose basically none of the above. The growth of the nones, N-O-N-E-S, as we affectionately call it. It is really quite a remarkable thing, and I want to, in this time together, first to document the rise of the nones. Secondly, to look at the diversity within the growing number of the unaffiliated. It's often mistaken. The claim is made that these people are secular. Not all of them. In fact, the majority of them are not secular in terms of being atheists or agnostics. Something else is going on here. Thirdly, I want to discuss a little bit about the proximate causes behind this, and of that we're pretty sure. We think we've got a good grasp on what's driving up those numbers. And then I'd like to conclude by looking, stepping back a little bit from our immediate data and talking about root causes. of this phenomenon. There I'll talk about the research of others and the three major theories that are out there concerning this phenomenon. I would invite you, particularly with that section, for you folks to jump in. I know several of you cover religion, and all of you are keen observers of the scene, so you no doubt have come to some conclusions on that as well. I'm always reminded when I speak to non-researchers of Bill Bennett's famous saying about the social sciences. It's the elaborate demonstration of the obvious through methods that are obscure. And so, if we're picking up something through our obscure methods, it must be pretty obvious out there, so I would really welcome your insights on this. So let's begin with documenting the trend. And here is the big picture going back to 72. We could have gone before then. This is from the General Social Survey. In the last 40 years, in terms of religious affiliation or identification, I use those terms interchangeably, there are three big patterns that one observes in the American religious scene. The steady decline of Protestantism, the steady uptick in the number of the unaffiliated, and I emphasize the seeming stability of the Roman Catholic Church. Seeming stability. In the aggregate, it seems to be ending up as a percentage where it's been. In fact, I think you could argue, and we could talk about some of this, that the Roman Catholic Church has experienced the most profound change of any of these religious traditions. But yet, in the aggregate, it appears like it's steady as a rock. So basically, in the 1950s, if you look at Gallup data, about 2% of Americans said that they were unaffiliated with any religion. And that held true until the late 60s. There was an uptick in the early 70s to 7%, and it stayed there for a couple of decades. Then all of a sudden, in the early 90s, we begin to see the number increase. So it took 30 years for the percentage of the unaffiliated to go up 5 percentage points. It then took 10 years to go up the next 5%. And it's taken 5 years to go up the next percent, 5%. So it's not only growing, but at this point seems to be growing in an accelerated pace. A lot of this is in the aggregate, the growth of the unaffiliated and the declining share of Protestants. For the first time in our history, Protestants have become a minority in this country, 48%. So that's where the main decline in an aggregate sense has been occurring. It especially concentrated, and I'll get into these numbers a bit more, but you can already see it there visually, particularly concentrated among white Protestants. Blacks and Latino Protestants have tended to, and Asian Protestants have tended to hold their own in terms of percentage. But among white Protestants, both evangelical and mainline, there has been a decrease. There has been a corresponding increase in the non-identifiers, the religious independents, the nuns. Again, 5 percentage points just in the last 5 years, from 15 to 20%. Notice I'm already beginning to break down this group a little bit to signal that not all these folks are secular. Only, less than 30%, in fact, are atheists and agnostics.
What are they?
Well, I'm going to show you, Mike. Thank you very much. You're right on me. Hold on for just 1 second. Let me put, again, a little bit more concrete figures here, because I just want to say, when you look at this chart, again, it's a much busier chart. It's the fuller picture. Again, you see a decline of 5% among Christians and heavily concentrated among Protestants. This is among all Americans.
All Americans.
This is all Americans, with 100% of the population. So a 5% decline among Christians in the last 5-6 years, and it's coming in the aggregate from Protestants. And notice that is coming in also from evangelical Protestants. I think the perception is out there that this is all coming from mainline Protestantism. Not true. It has also come from evangelical Protestantism. Now, the decline in percentage terms has been less. I think if you do the figures there, 10% decline among evangelicals, 17% among the mainliners. So it is more heavily concentrated among mainline Protestantism, but evangelical Protestantism is also feeling this. And again, the rise of the unaffiliated and the growing number, primarily through immigration, of other faiths, you know, Muslims, Hindus, Buddhists, etc. Now, let's talk about the demographics of what's happening here, because this is very, very important. This is taking place across most demographic groups. Among men and women, although notice that there's still a gap between the two. On every religious measure, women are more religious than men. But it's also happening, the phenomenon of disaffiliation is also happening among women. And even across regions, the South, for instance, is not immune to this. You know, 3 percentage point growth among the unaffiliated. It's happening there as well. Yes, the Northeast and particularly the Northwest are particularly unchurched, if you want to use that term. But it's happening everywhere. So it must be something about that Pacific air, because if you look at Statistics Canada, if you look at Statistics Canada, for instance, I just did recently, we're doing a little piece, one of my researchers, BC has by far the highest percentage of unaffiliated. I mean, it's 40% in British Columbia. I mean, it's just out of sight. And all the other Canadian provinces are much lower. So that Northwest, both in the U.S. and, you know, and for Canada, seems to have the highest concentration of unaffiliated. Now, there are two exceptions, and I already signaled one of them when I talked about Protestantism, when it comes to demographics. The one is race. The increase among the unaffiliated has taken place primarily among whites, as you can see in this chart. Now, there's a reason there's a light shading for blacks here, and that means that it's within the margin of error. You know, so those of you who are statisticians, remember we always talk about the 95% confidence interval. If you want to relax that just a little bit, let's say to 90% confidence interval, we would darken the black one here, right? Because it would be statistically significant, but not at the typical confidence level that we report on. And none among Hispanics. Although, again, I think this bears watching. Now, Elizabeth, before you ask me, because I often call me about data on Latinos, if you check your notes, I'd probably give you a different number for the percentage of unaffiliated among Latinos. Here's at 16%. In fact, we think it's 13%. The reason is that these are aggregated polls that are what we call modified bilingual. That is to say, interviewers call, and they, if they identify Hispanics who can't answer the questions in English, they will then get a Spanish interviewer to jump in. That's good, but not nearly as good as having a fully bilingual interviewer who can switch just like that. You get a lot more of the Hispanic community when you do a fully bilingual survey. It's very expensive. We're going to repeat the 2006 survey we did with our colleagues at the Pew Hispanic Center and this summer, as a matter of fact, a fully bilingual and a high end of about 5,000 people so that we can get, you know, not only Mexicans and Catholics, those groups you always get because there's a large percentage of the Latino population, but other nationality groups like Puerto Ricans and Cubans and Dominicans and Salvadorans, and as well as get non-Catholics and break that down, in serious way. So you're going to, I probably gave you 13, now you know why, right? This is fully bilingual, this is modified bilingual. I lobbied long and hard, and this was instituted 3 or 4 years ago at the Pew Research Center, even with Andy Kohut's project, that every survey ought to be at least modified bilingual, because if not, you're not really reaching the Latino community in a way that you can count on your accuracy. Now, let's talk about, as I told you, this is a very dynamic religious marketplace. You know, over 50% of people who change their religious affiliation at least once in their lifetime. Everybody in every religious group in this country is losing members. Every religious group is gaining members. Right? The key is, what's the net effect of that? So here is the recruitment side of religious switching. And what you see here is that the unaffiliated are growing massively through, I call it conversions, in question, you know, quotation marks. This is amazing. 74% of all people who tell us they're unaffiliated grew up in a religious tradition. Very, very different, you know, from among Protestants and Catholics. Much lower levels of recruitment, although not insignificant. Sometimes I've given this talk to, Catholic bishops and others, and said, but look at the huge number who come in through RCIA every Easter. Yeah, that's happening. And, you know, it's reflected here. About 11% of Catholics were raised something else. But you have to then look at the other side, which is the retention, right? Because it's the net effect of the two. And what I find interesting about this is that the unaffiliated are not immune from this competitive religious marketplace. It's not as though people become unaffiliated and just, you know, never change. I mean, they're also, in fact, the retention rate for the unaffiliated is not particularly good. If you look at Protestantism, manages to hold on to about 80% of people who were raised Protestant. Catholics, not as good, only to 64%. That means that one-third of people who were raised Catholic are something else. But the unaffiliated, you know, is 58%. So those people who are raised unaffiliated don't necessarily stay there. I mean, that's a significant, you know, 40%. Of the folks who sort of leave those ranks. But again, you have to put these two things together. And if you look at the Catholic numbers, for instance, for every four Catholics who have left through the back door, only one has come in through the front. Right? And that's the picture I try to paint for the bishops. As you know, it's not just, yes, you can look at the great number who are coming in through RCIA, but what's happening to those who were raised Catholic? So it's not a very good proportion, by the way. I'm not, this is the topic for a different discussion, but you can tell already why I said that perhaps the change internally has been most profound among the Roman Catholic Church. And the reason is, we're not going to get into this, but it's immigration. You know, among immigrants to this country, Catholics outnumber Protestants by 2-1. And then those immigrants have the highest fertility rate of any group in this country, Latino Catholics. And so those folks have basically replaced those other three, right, have been replaced by Hispanics, which is why the proportion of Hispanics in the Roman Catholic Church is increasing. 50% of all Catholics under 40 in this country are Latino. So they have made up for that difference. It's really quite remarkable. So it seems stable, but in fact, it's undergone profound change. By the way, there's even a great number, about 9% of the population who are, I affectionately call them reverts. You know, they start out in one tradition, wander around in a couple of others, including, by the way, they pass through an unaffiliated phase and then come back. So nothing is ever completely settled. Nothing, you know, the dust never quite settles when it comes to religious changes in this country. Now, I'm going to get to your question, Mike, sorting out these folks. Secondly, I want to talk a little bit about some of the internal differences within the ranks of the unaffiliated. And to do that, I have to put on the table one key question we ask. It's the salience question, as social scientists say, the importance question. How important is religion in your life? And we use that measure to begin to sort out the unaffiliated. Now, among the general public, about 60% tell us that religion is very important in their lives. This is the whole U.S. population of adults. And another 22% say, you know, it's somewhat important. So about 80% of Americans tell us religion is at least somewhat important in their lives. It's 33% among the unaffiliated. Over 40% among those who tell us they are nothing in particular. So there are three ways, aside from a volunteered response, that in our surveys people can get into this category of the unaffiliated. They can tell us that they're an atheist or an agnostic or nothing in particular. Or they can just volunteer the option, look, I'm nothing, before we even get to the end. So we use this measure then to break down these folks between atheists and agnostics, for whom, remember, for some of these folks, religion is at least somewhat important. Not many, but particularly among agnostics. I use this measure to break down the unaffiliated into three buckets. Let's call the first one hardcore seculars, for lack of a better term, atheists and agnostics. You know, about less than 30% of this group. Now, that's 6% of the U.S. population, if I can translate it into larger demographic trends. So that's not insignificant. But there's an equal number among the unaffiliated who are what we call the religious unaffiliated. That is, people who said they are nothing in particular, but who tell us religion is at least somewhat important in their lives. That's about an equal, in fact, an equal number as with the atheists and agnostics. So another 6% of the U.S. population. So far from being hardcore seculars, you have, in fact, a high percentage of these folks for whom religion, I mean, who have a very vital religious pulse, if I can put it in those terms. Then you've got, you know, what I call the religiously indifferent. They're not against it, they're not for it, they're just sort of riding through. They don't have strong views on this, one way or the other. And in case you're wondering whether this works, it really does carry over into other measures of religiosity. Whether they identify themselves as a religious person, look at the difference. You know, 50% of the religious unaffiliated say, yeah, I'm a religious person. 64% of these people say, I believe in God with absolute certainty. 50% say they pray daily or more. So for that, this is not an irreligious segment here. In fact, some of these measures, didn't want to overburden you, but some of these measures stack up very well against the least connected of those who say they are affiliated. I mean, this is a pretty religious group, that 6% of the U.S. population who are unaffiliated but are significantly religious. Now, I don't want to carry this analysis through. By the way, we've broken this down for political implications. I mean, one of the things that always perplexed me when I came to work with the Pew Research Center is the number of seculars, that's what we used to call this category, by the way, who said they wanted a president with strong religious beliefs. What's that about? All right. Well, when you break it down into the various groups among the unaffiliated, you begin to see that there are some significant differences within that group. But going forward, I'm just going to collapse what I'm calling the religious unaffiliated and the religiously indifferent. That's 71%. If not, it would get too unwieldy. Even when we collapse it, though, I think you see wide differences in a variety of measures between the NIPs, as we call them internally, the nothing in particulars, and atheists and agnostics. To be sure, they're not as believing as affiliated Americans, not surprisingly, but 2/3 of the unaffiliated believe in God or universal spirit, and over 80% of the nothings in particular. So this is a pretty theistic crowd, these nothings in particular. I'll go through these quickly. I just want to hammer home the point. If you look at frequency of prayer, very similar category. 90% for the U.S. public who pray regularly, only 40% among the unaffiliated, but it's still 40%, and it's 50% plus among the nothings in particular. So it's a consistent pattern until you get to frequency of worship attendance. Next to race, by the way, we do these regression analysis. Again, the methods that are obscure. After every election, and next to race, church attendance is the most reliable predictor of how people voted. Even in elections in which religion doesn't seem to matter, we run the regression analysis, and here it comes again. This is very interesting. Again, it gets at the underlying dynamic here that we want to probe in more detail. When it comes to attendance at religious worship, the nothing in particular is, in fact, more closely resemble now the atheism and agnostics. Very low levels of attendance. Again, about 48% of affiliated Americans tell us they attend church, synagogue, etc., weekly. It's only 5% among the unaffiliated, and in single digits among the nothing in particular. This measure, by the way, would be, you know, the gap would be even greater were it not for the low percentage of white mainliners who tell us they attend at least weekly, only about a quarter. But it's still, you know, a significant difference. And here, the unaffiliated, the vast majority of them tell us they seldom or never attend. So whatever religious life they have, it is not a life that they have in community, in connection with religious institutions. It is a sort of customized, individualized form of spirituality. Again, we'll talk more about that. Now, I always get the questions, well, yeah, that's true in terms of some traditional measures, but alternative spiritualities are sky high among the unaffiliated. I often hear that. New age, Eastern religions. Well, yes, that, it is there. But what I found very interesting, if you look at these other spiritual beliefs like spiritual energy and yoga as a spiritual practice, reincarnation, astrology, the evil eye, yeah, it's there, but at precisely the same level as we find it among the affiliated. So that person sitting next to you in mass or church, you know, at the same percentage as the unaffiliated are into these beliefs and into these practices. Being in touch with someone who's died, consulting psychics, being in the presence of a ghost. The only difference is on this religious or mystical experiences. It's much lower among the unaffiliated. But again, on these alternative spiritualities, yes, it's there among the unaffiliated, but at no greater rate than among affiliated Americans. So I'm not sure that that really provides much of a clue. We do know that the unaffiliated do reflect on the meaning of life, not nearly to the extent as affiliated Americans, but still there, you know, at 53%. That's significant. So all of this helps shed light on this whole issue, again, something I'm always asked about, the spiritual but not religious. How many Americans are spiritual but not religious in the way they define themselves? Well, here you have the definitive answer. 20%. 20%. About 15% of those who are affiliated, so 15% of the 80%, and almost 4 out of 10 among the unaffiliated describe themselves as spiritual but not religious. When you add those two together, that's 20% of the U.S. population who say they are spiritual but not religious.
So, Luis.
Yes.
Just to clarify, sorry, Amy.
Yeah.
So that's a self-identification question. What was the wording of it?
Well, we don't ask, some others have asked, are you spiritual but not religious? We ask those questions separately. So in one battery would be, you know, do you consider yourself a religious person? In another battery, do you consider yourself a spiritual person? And then we melt. It is, often happens with these things, it's better to do the analysis when you ask the question separately. If not, people, what do you mean? You know, and it's very hard to put together. So we have a pretty high degree of confidence here.
So you're not adding in some of the religious beliefs and practices and creating a measure of spiritual
Correct.
Beliefs.
This is strictly on the basis of self-identification.
Okay. So
this is a big group. Most of you are logged on. If you go to SBNR, There was a lively website, and that stands for spiritual but not religious. Their tagline, by the way, it's something right out of Jeff Goldberg. Their tagline is, love is the answer, you are the question. That's the tagline for SBNR.org. Check it out. It's quite interesting.
That's so deep, I don't know what he's talking about.
So, I think this phenomenon of sort of individualized religiosity, if you want to call it that, may also help account for the explosion in the number of spiritual directors. I started picking up on this some time ago, and then I think it was Lisa Wangdis for the Boston Globe who did a very nice piece on the growth of spiritual directors. Now, there are traditions like Catholicism and Anglicanism that have always had this, but this is a different kind, driven by millennials, basically. And so, she checked out with Spiritual Directors International. There is such a group. It's the single largest group of these folks here. And it turns out that these spiritual directors have grown in number from 400 in 1990 to over 6,000 today. And it makes a lot of sense, this customized spirituality without the pressure of having to belong to a group. Right? And just like you have, a life coach and, personal trainers and all, then you got a spiritual director who can customize, the package for your individual needs. So, the rise of this sort of personal autonomy in religion is sort of the flip side of the decline of institutional authority. Right? If you think about it, those are very closely connected. So there is a lot of religion among these folks, but it's not of an institutionalized nature. In fact, we ask people specifically, we ask the unaffiliated, are you looking for a religion to call home? And 9 out of 10 of them say, no, we're not. We're not looking for a religion. Because again, it's widely, I've heard this from many people, these are seekers who are looking for an institutional connection. We don't find it. There is a percentage of them that do, but most of these folks are perfectly happy with their customized, individualized brand of religiosity. Now, what's driving this change? Well, as I said, we can be very, very certain on two major factors that are driving the change. The proximate causes, if you want to call them that. We have direct evidence for this. And one of them is generational change, unquestionably. I mean, if you take a snapshot of the U.S. public today and divide them by age cohorts, this is the picture you get. Now, millennials, 33%, 1 out of 3, are unaffiliated with any religious institution.
Define millennials.
Millennials, I've got to define there, 18 through 29.
Okay.
The Gen Xers are actually the 30 to 49, the next level down. Then the boomers, that's the 50 to 64, and then we collapse the silent generation and the greatest generation into one. Notice the step up in disaffiliation with each one of those generations. Somebody had a question. Mike, I don't want to usurp. I know how sensitive you are about people usurping your moderator role.
They raise their hand to be on the list.
Right. Oh, okay. All right. Because if it is a quick clarification, journalists are very inventive. They can drive trucks through clarification questions and to ask more substantive ones. We're on to that. All right.
We're really eager to hear the political implications.
Yeah, we're going to get to that. But this is primarily in the rise of the unaffiliated, and it does have political implications, but it has much broader social implications than just political. So I know what many of you are thinking. Well, but isn't this simply a life cycle change issue? That is to say, sure, millennials today look like they're more disaffiliated, but over time they will join up. Well, here is the picture that emerges when we take a look at that life cycle effect on affiliation. The answer is there's no life cycle effect. generations tend to end up pretty much where they begin. It's happened with, again, the greatest, the silent, the boomers, and the Gen Xers. So at least based on what we know, there's no reason to suspect that it's going to increase rapidly among the millennials. Now, that's not to say, so let me just make one point before I move on this one. So if each generation pretty much ends up where it started, and each subsequent cohort is starting out less affiliated, as the more recent cohorts displace the older cohorts, the overall levels of affiliation are dropping. Right? I mean, it's demography is destiny on this variable. Now, that's not to say, and here's where people's instincts are correct, that people don't become more religious as they age. They certainly do. Look at the importance of religion, for example. There is a life cycle effect for other measures of religiosity. Though, please note again, that each successive cohort is starting out at lower level than the previous cohort. So, 10 percent point drop among the greatest and the silent. And an especially pronounced uptick among the boomers, 20%. That's significant. In fact, Frank Newport, the head of the Gallup organization, has just come out with a book, God is Alive and Well, The Future of Religion in America. And he thinks that we're on the cusp of a religious renaissance in this country. And he really bases that on the boomers and what we're seeing among boomers. He believes they will become even more religious as they age, and by their sheer numbers, they will shift the country into a more religious mode. Some of his arguments, by the way, are quite interesting. Boomers obsess with their well-being, and he points out to the studies that have shown the link between levels of religious commitment and better mental and physical health, and the boomers being who they are and looking for well-being, they're going to gravitate towards religion. He even suspects that businesses and even government will catch on to this and find ways to incentivize people to worship and, you know, to be part of a religious community.
Doesn't this contradict everything you've just told us?
Well, I'm not sure. If he's talking, you know, if it's affiliation, it certainly does. You know, and if it's on the importance of religion or even something like daily prayer, you could see it going up. The problem is that with all of these charts, and this is the problem for his thesis, is that unless the boomers really become a lot more religious than the previous generations in that age span, you know, they're still going to end up lower than where previous generations were. So its cumulative impact on the population is just not going to be what he predicts. But he thinks that boomers, you know, given their great demographic weight and how they, you know, they become more religious. Now, they may not become more affiliated, oh, right? But they, in his view, they will become a lot more religious. Okay. Even, this is it, there is even a life cycle effect on attendance at religious services. So people do tend to attend a little more, this is not as pronounced, they do tend to attend a little more as they age. They don't affiliate anymore as they age, but they do attend a little more. And here you see, of course, with the greatest, maybe that's the mortality factor that kicks in, you know, 12% rather, you know, at the end of life. The second one, so I think generational displacement is clearly a driving factor here. Of that, we're quite certain. The second one, we're also quite confident, but it's a little more difficult to grasp. It's what we call the growing social acceptability of not being religiously affiliated. And no, I don't think people necessarily lie to us. I think religious identity, actually not unlike party identity in politics, you know, it's not something that's fixed. It changes, even in a short period of time, how people define themselves. But what you clearly see here is that the ranks of the unaffiliated are being fed by the creasters, as we call them. you know, those who go Christmas and Easter, you know, the C&Es. Those who have a very, very tangential relationship to their faith community. From 38 to 49% in that category now claim to be unaffiliated. Notice it's pretty stable among those who attend weekly or more, as well as those who attend monthly. So what you're seeing here, and you'll see it in a couple more charts, is a sort of hollowing of the middle. You know, we often, and the Pew Research Center has done studies on political polarization. There is a certain kind of religious polarization going on, that the folks in the middle, you know, are tending to drop out altogether rather than retaining a religious identity, while the folks who are most religious, in fact, aren't budging. This is not Europe where that's tanking. That's holding steady. But it's the folks in the middle who seem to be dropping out, into one of the two extremes, if you want to call it that. I'm impressed by the fact that a lot of these folks simply drift off. You know, this is a very difficult thing to get at. Why are people, you know, when they leave a religion for the other, why do they do it? And I'm just continually impressed with the fact that many of them simply drift off. Yes, they will also point to certain, concrete things that bother them and so forth, but it's this sense of drift that I find most interesting. People just drift, 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 and eventually say, you know what, it's no use calling myself Catholic anymore or Protestant. I'm nothing. So when you give me that option, you know, I'm nothing in particular. There's even a group, I had to throw this chart in for Bob Putnam. He did a big survey. He's spoken here on the findings of this for American Grace and David Campbell, in which they actually repeated the interview, I think it was like 8 months later, to the same group of people. It was like sort of a mini panel study. You interview them at point A, and then you interview the same people. I think it was 9 months later. And they found that, in fact, about 10% of those people who used to say they're affiliated now say they're unaffiliated, and vice versa. So they call them the liminals. Well, he actually calls them the unstable nuns, which I don't want to use that term. let's stick with liminal, you know, like threshold in Latin. You know, these are people who can't decide whether they're in or out. And of course, you say, well, something changed in their life. Well, they did the research. No other religious measure changed. They were identical in every other respect except in what they call themselves in a nine-month period. So it's fascinating. So look, whether Americans are becoming more religious or not, everyone agrees that they are drifting away from organized religion, that their ties with it have frayed. They still believe, many of them, but they are, to quote Grace Davey, who also presented here several years ago, a sociologist from the UK, if they are believing, they're believing without belonging. That's the best way to describe this increasing number of groups. Believing without belonging. Now you want to politics, Mike? Let's see, we've got...
Five minutes.
10 minutes. Let's say 10 minutes. And I can come back to this. Let's say 10. So let's talk a little bit about root causes. And again, I don't think these are mutually exclusive. All of this could be at play. But one theory that Putnam has popularized is that the rise of the unaffiliated reflects a political backlash against the religious right. That given the strong nexus between the GOP and evangelicals, that millennials especially have expressed their distaste for that kind of arrangement by saying they prefer no religion at all. All right, so it's a backlash against that. Actually, a couple of UC Berkeley sociologists wrote the first piece on this, Howden Fisher. And to be very fair, Howden Fisher say this is a conjecture. Putnam says he's highly suggestive. In his book, in his public commentary, he's a bit bolder on that. So what's the evidence for this, that it's this mixture of religion and politics and the Christian right that's driving many of these folks to say, look, religion is tainted. I just don't want to be associated with any of it. Well, timing is one of them. They make, you know, big to-do about timing. And indeed, if you look at the timing and the growth of the religious and affiliated, it corresponds, you know, with the heyday of the religious right. But the second point they make is look at the profile of the unaffiliated. Look at their political profile. You know, this suggests that they're actually opting out of religion because of that unit, of that nexus between evangelicals and the GOP. Well, I'm going to mention a couple of things that may provide some indirect evidence for this, but this, whether it's a good or bad theory, it provides an opening to talk about the political profile of the unaffiliated, which I know many of you folks would find inherently interesting. So here it is, in a very short order. And then, Mike, maybe we can come back to some of the others. What do we see here very clearly? This is in the context of the last election cycle. About twice as many Americans as a whole describe themselves as conservative as describe themselves as liberal. Among the unaffiliated, it's precisely the reverse. Twice as many consider themselves liberal as consider themselves conservative. So a huge gap between the unaffiliated and the unaffiliated, despite the fact that some affiliated groups, you know, have a very low incidence of people who classify as conservatives, specifically African Americans, as you can see there. On social and political issues, there is just no question. They are much more liberal on social issues like abortion and same-sex marriage. Again, you can see the 25-point difference between the unaffiliated and the affiliated on the question of abortion, over 30 points on the question of gay marriage. In fact, Putnam's more specific thesis is that it's the Christian right's focus on gay issues that has turned off a lot of millennials and prompted them to become unaffiliated. Interestingly, by the way, when you ask the broader ideology question on bigger government, more services, smaller government, fewer services, unaffiliated track with the general population. They're not as liberal on that score as with these social issues. Of course, party follows ideology increasingly, and this country is part of the political polarization. And as you can see here, among all registered voters, again, this is in the January-July period during the election, 5 points in favor of the Democrats. Among the unaffiliated, 37 points. Heavily liberal, heavily Democratic. About 70% of these folks voted for Barack Obama in the last election. So huge gaps between the affiliated, among whom, incidentally, is a 3-point margin for the Republicans, despite the number that really sticks out at you down there among African Americans, black Protestants, 80 percentage points, you know, for the Democrats. And we don't have it here, it's a different poll, but among Latino Catholics, it's 50 percentage points in favor of the Democrats. So even despite that, there's a significant gap between the affiliated and unaffiliated. In fact, this is a fascinating development. The unaffiliated have become the single largest religious bloc, if you want to use that term, within the Democratic Party. They now account for about a quarter of the Democratic constituencies. Notice who's second, African Americans. So the Democratic Party has both the most secular religious bloc and the most religious group in this country, African Americans, by every measure. The least and the most, which is really quite fascinating. Maybe some of the controversy, I know a lot of it focused on the status of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, but there was also this, you know, fairly significant debate about, you know, God in that one reference, you know, the God-given potential in the Democratic platform, which also, you know, caused quite a bit of friction. Might this indicate, you know, on the question of religion, you know, some friction going forward within the Democratic Party? I don't know. You can ask Antonio Villaraigosa, the mayor of Los Angeles, who had to confront that reality head on in the convention. They had 3 votes People were not at all convinced that two-thirds, voted to bring this back in. Look, they're both more liberal, more democratic. They're also, much more negative, or let's put it this way, not as positive on religion as some, the affiliated folks. So if you look at views on churches and religious organizations, about 70% of these folks tell us the religion is, they're too involved in politics. Churches are just too involved in politics. But, that's not much different from saying that, churches focus too much on rules, they're too concerned with money and power, et cetera. So not explicitly political reasons. Interestingly, they do acknowledge the role of religious institutions about bringing people together to strengthen community bonds. That's kind of interesting, given their aversion, to being part of groups. But they see that, and they play an important role in helping the poor and the needy, less so on the morality in society. A couple more here, and we'll wrap up this, and then we can go on, Mike. When you look at views on religion and politics, it's quite clear that there is an aversion here. I think I've already alluded to this presidents with strong religious beliefs. Huge difference. Among the unaffiliated, 75% want a president with strong religious beliefs. Among the unaffiliated, it's only 32%. Among the religious unaffiliated, by the way, to reintroduce that category, it is 63%. I mean, that's the group that we keep picking up among these seculars. On the question of churches keeping out of political matters, this last one's very interesting. Notice the gap there is very small. Churches should not endorse candidates. This is the one question where we consistently find the most consensus among American religious groups, from the most religious to the most secular. It's as though these folks welcome the vast majority of Americans, religion's role in politics, including when politicians bring it into play. But when it edges onto the question of institutional autonomy, as it were, they really draw back from too close an identification of religious institutions with politics. So they welcome religion in public life, the majority do, but they draw back on shortening the distance, the institutional distance between church and state. All right, I think we can talk about some of the other things later. I think delayed secularization is a second theory. The third one I do want to get to at some point, Mike, because I do think that it may be the case that what we're seeing in religious disaffiliation has, in fact, little to do with religion, that religious institutions may be implicated in a much broader narrative in American society, which is impacting institutions across the board. And religious institutions are simply getting caught up in that. So this is what some of the religious leaders breathe a little sigh of relief because they drew the immediate conclusion. It may not be anything that we're doing in particular, although they acknowledge there's a lot they can do to improve, but that there are some stiff headwinds out there that's taking along all institutions with it. Now, from political parties to bowling leagues, and that's the power of Putnam's metaphor of bowling alone. I have the chart there where you see the bowling leagues just tanking, even though the number of people bowling is rising, bowling leagues are disappearing. So it may be a much bigger thing going on here, which I want to make a strong pitch based on the demographic evidence that we probably should be paying a lot more attention to marriage as one of those units, one of those institutions that, along with its lessening, we're no longer wedded to the idea of marriage, as it were. It's really taking along a lot of other institutions with it. But
thank you, Luis. Yeah.